Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 20th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Musical Structure and the Meaning of Hymns, presented by Peter Mercer Taylor. This number, MEP 2005-03.
I've seen most of you before, some of you I have not, so I'll kind of start from the beginning briefly. I am Peter Mercer Taylor, here from St. Paul, Minnesota, where I live with my family. I teach at the University of Minnesota. I'm a musicologist there on the faculty of the School of Music. And most of what I do with my days is to teach and write about Felix Mendelssohn and various other classical topics, mostly early 19th century classical topics, Mendelssohn in particular. I also am seriously engaged with the study of popular music in various ways. I teach a couple of different classes about rock and have written about various rock topics, about bands near and dear to me, REM, the Bangles, various other people, and I would be happy to take that up on your own time if you have any interest in talking about those things too. I'm here with my three kids and my wife, and I don't have the first idea of where they are right now. They will proceed as though they know what they're doing, and get right into our third conversation of the week on the topic of hymns. In our first conversation on Monday, we opened up the field of discussion to what strikes me as, do we all have hymnals back there?
Oh, thank you. Sorry. No.
What strikes me as one of the central, most pressing issues facing a musicologist like myself, a music historian, somebody sort of immersed in the history and the criticism and the analysis of classical music, and what really faces a music historian when a music historian confronts the repertoire of hymns. Because in a curious sense, hymns have never been paid all that much attention to by music historians. There are historians of hymns, what we call hymnologists, people who dedicate themselves frequently to the study of texts and the way the different texts have been, say, authored, developed, published, disseminated across, throughout regions or nations or throughout the world. And there are people who have sort of examined the history of hymn melodies, which is an interesting study in itself. Many fewer such people who do that kind of work. Eric Routley, one very prominent sort of hymnologist who dedicated much of his career to the study of melodies through the middle of the 20th century. But I realized at a certain point a few years ago that there doesn't seem to be anyone all that interested in examining hymns in terms of what seems to interest musicologists most when it comes to text and music, which is the relationship between music and texts. When musicologists deal with operas, or motets, or art songs, or madrigals, or any number of other kinds of texted music, the question that is always first and foremost is, what did this composer do to bring these words to life? What does the music do to tell the story that the words themselves set out to tell? How do the two participate together to create a single sense? And that is the sort of central theme of this week's set of conversations, is just how music participates in the business of sense-making where hymns are concerned. And we've tangled in the course of the week thus far with a couple of different kind of thorny issues that one has to tackle in asking this question. Last time, for example, we tackled what's probably the thorniest of them all, the fact that hymn tunes and hymn texts often come together entirely by accident, and they're often sort of mixed and matched in utterly different, seemingly arbitrary ways across the history of hymnal publishing. And so you might have the same text set in the course of its life to 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 different melodies along the way. And to try to claim that all of those melodies sort of tell the story of that text somehow, rarely makes sense. So it's not nearly as tidy a situation as we have with a Mozart opera. We got Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, one opera. It's, music by Mozart. We don't even care who wrote the words. It was Lorenzo de Ponte, but, most of us don't even know this name. It's music by Mozart. Mozart put his stamp on that thing, and it's one giant monolithic setting of that text. Well, hymns just don't work that way. Hymns get kind of shuffled around in all kinds of different ways. So that is one of the great challenges facing hymn composers, or this kind of study of hymns, and there are other challenges that we'll sort of tangle with in the course of today's conversation. The conversation was sort of opened and broadly examined in Monday's session. Yesterday, we talked about this business of having, say, more than one melody fit the same set of words, and today we're going to talk about what I would like to describe as kind of structural correspondences between a hymn text and a hymn music, the musical setting of a hymn. And what I mean by structural correspondences, what I mean by saying that I would like to address musical structure, I hope is not a scary concept to most of us. In a certain sense, this, above all the sessions this week, among the five conversations that I'll be here having about hymns, this is the one that's most kind of labor-intensive where the music theory is concerned, which is to say, we'll be talking about a few notes. We'll be talking about the way sort of measures follow measures and phrases follow phrases and things like that. And if at any point, this is all going to be sort of baby steps on our way into this stuff, we're not getting too advanced with any of it, but if at any point along the way you just are not getting the language, this obviously is not a failure of your own personal engagement with hymns. This isn't a failure of the way your ears work. This is just sort of me not communicating what is probably a pretty simple idea that I'm trying to get across. So by all means, just raise your hands and say, you know, slow the heck down. You know, run us by, you know, run that by us again. I'd be very happy to take a second or third sweep through anything that we tangle with today. I actually want to begin this conversation about musical structure trying to give some sense of what I'm referring to when I'm referring to musical structure, and you mean many different things by that, but one thing I think comes to life if we look at a tune that we didn't have a chance to look at yesterday, though I was kind of hoping that we would, a tune that we find in the Lutheran Book of Worship set to two different texts. And I'd like to sing the first verse of both of these different texts. The tune is one of the more celebrated ones in the hymnal. It shows up in the Lutheran Book of Worship on page 82, for example. Does everybody have a Lutheran Book of Worship in front of him or her? 82. Big number in the upper left corner. You have to, if you're not familiar with the Lutheran Book of Worship, there's a lot of sort of liturgical material for the front, psalms, that kind of stuff. So you sort of have to get through it before you can get page one right. So if we've all found hymn 82, Asrith, Gladness, Men of Old, let us sing this hymn and ask ourselves, what do this hymn and this set of words have to do with one another? And again, the question here, let the cat out of the bag a bit, the question that I really want to ask about this, do we have enough hymnals upstairs? Do you need one?
I have.
The question I really want to ask is sort of in terms of large-scale structure. That is the way the entire thing...
That's it.
The
lights
are more
light.
The windows.
Oh, yeah, we can certainly open the windows. Thank you. The way that the musical structure, the way that the whole thing unfolds in correspondence with the way the entire poem unfolds. Let's just sort of give the first verse of this thing a sing. And by the way, we're going to be accompanied today for the second time this week by Peter Eisensee, a volunteer who arrived here at Holden Village with no idea that he would be taking part in any of this time. But trust me, he's a much better piano player than me, and I very much appreciate his help today. Let's give it up for Peter. Peter, who just started this in with the last line of this thing. So page 82, as with Gladness, Men of Old, hymn 82. Let's just sing through the first verse of this. Let's sing this hymn again, but with a different set of words, a set of words that was more familiar to me in association with this tune growing up, For the Beauty of the Earth.
Yes.
And let's sing the first verse of this old psalm verse and see how it goes. Peter, when you're ready. 561, I'm sorry. Here we go.
For the beauty of the earth, for the beauty of the skies, for the love which from our earth over and around us lies, Christ our Lord to you be raised, this our sacrifice of praise.
Fantastic. In terms of topical matter, you all are the best best singers of the week. Don't say that to anybody who was here yesterday and not today, but you all sound great.
They were in the choir yesterday, and that's why you didn't have them.
They had sounded great in choir, too. But if we have one figure in 561, one on 82, we see that these two hymns, in terms of their topical matter, their subject matter, they don't have all that much to do with each other. They're not really about the same thing. And it seems, in a sense to me, as though we're not really dealing with a hymn in which there are very close correspondences between, say, words and texts. We sometimes find these, out of the depths I cry to thee. When you begin with a tune like that we looked at on Monday, well, we have this tune and it plunges down to a depth, out of the depths. And suddenly we have this painting going on and sitting right there on the surface, and you can just kind of pick that thing up immediately and take it to the bank. This close correspondence, text painting, between what happens in a text and what happens in the music. It does not strike me that all that much of that kind of thing is going on in either of the hymns we just sang. But what is going on? That is, sort of on the grandest scale, what is it about the sort of structure of this music and the structure of these two different poems that makes them both kind of work to this tune, which I think they do? What can we say about this? And you can start with either one of them if you like.
Well, it's a lovely melody that seems to be easy to sing, or we're very familiar with it.
Yeah.
They both fit.
They both fit. Mm-hmm. And how do they fit? Is there something in particular that makes them fit? Well, certainly the syllables fit.
Yeah, the match up poetry.
Phrasing,
yeah.
And the words, too.
The phrasing works extremely nice.
The beauty of the earth, pause for them, but, you know, reiteration.
Right. Right, right. And that is, there is this insistent sort of rhythmic sameness, phrase after phrase, that sure helps, at least for the beauty of the earth. Other things about that?
They seem like they're both uplifting.
Yeah, they do. Are they more uplifting in certain places than others? I mean, are they sort of start uplifting and stay up, or what happens in the course of this tune, for example?
They all go up and then they come on back down.
Yeah, they do. Where's the highest note in the tune?
D.
Isn't that D? Yeah, where does that D show up? That D in the last system, that is the third, I'm going to call these things systems, these little braces of music. But there are three of them on the page. If you're looking on page 82, for example, let's turn to 82 so we can all sort of be there together. There are three systems here. And in that second measure, as we say, of the last system, there on the bottom of the page, the sopranos get up to this note, D. So most gracious Lord, may we. And that's a note they haven't had before. It's been C at the top. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The same kind of gesture, but it never went as high before. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da da-da-da-da-da-da. So what happens in the last phrase to justify that, the last phrase of the poetry? Is there any good reason to suddenly haul out this D that we might, in the back of our heads, have been wanting all along?
Well, it's gracious Lord. It's the Lord we're singing about.
Yeah. Good. And this whole text, what do we do with it? As with gladness, men of old did the guiding star behold. As with joy they hailed its light, leading onward, beaming bright. So, most gracious Lord, may we evermore be led by thee. I mean, obviously, this is the big payoff. We're wondering, okay, I mean, this is a long sentence. It's a one-sentence stanza, isn't it? Then you're sort of wondering, okay, what's he getting at here? What, as with gladness, the men of old did this, there's the star, and that's all great. Where are we going with all this? Well, we're going to what we're going to arrive at. And here's the big payoff in the last line. Okay, we got the men of old, they did this. Where does that get us? Well, so, most gracious Lord, may we evermore be led by thee. And that is the big payoff. And with the big payoff comes the big melodic ascent to the highest pitch of the melody. The big, the first two lines have been sung to the same music. And then the real novelty. Okay, what about for the beauty of the earth? Flip over to 561. What happens in For the Beauty of the Earth? Well, once more, and you've already begun to get us down this path. For the beauty of the earth, for the beauty of the skies, we have this sort of litany, this repetitious thing happening. For the love which from our birth over and around us lies, Well, what about all that stuff? Again, a one-sentence stanza. These things are fairly novel, and again, we're left that whole time thinking, okay, where is he going with all this? Okay, we got this, we got that, we got that, and for the sake of all these things, we're going to do what? Well, finally we find out. Christ our Lord, to you we raise this our sacrifice of praise. And it's very important that this be such an end-weighted melody when it comes to both of these very end-weighted poems. That is, that they both are long sentences, sort of reaching us to the last line that's going to finally explain why are we talking about all this stuff in the first place. We only learn that in the last line of both of these poems. This is what I mean by a structural correspondence. It really isn't the same as text painting. It's not the same as a high note for the word high or a low note for the word depth. This is a sort of large-scale structural issue that is raised in the course of these two hymns, raised and resolved. These things correspond in a very satisfying structural way. Let's look quickly at Let Us Break Bread Together, which should be on one of your handouts. Do we all have that?
Just as an aside, isn't it nice for such a beautiful melody that would only be used at Christmas, that we use it much more?
Yeah. I certainly think so. Although, it does put me in mind of... I was kind of plowing through a 19th century hymnal the other day, and I was rather aghast to find a hymn that went like this. Let's see, I'll do it in key, I can sing it in. Come ye thankful people, come, praise the song of You can't sing, Come Ye Thankful People Come, that tune sometime besides Christmas, but do we really want it? I don't know.
Some churches don't have the taste that the Lutherans do.
That's right. But, well, yeah. And speaking of things
you
that the
Lutherans...
You can
talk about that for a long time. Yeah.
So, certainly the danger of offending somebody in the room. And speaking of things the Lutherans don't do, the Lutherans don't set Let Us Break Bread Together on our knees quite like this. This actually goes back to the 1966 United Methodist hymnal that I grew up with. And this is an arrangement by Carlton Robert Young, known to everybody as Sam, by Sam Young, one of the great sort of arrangers and co-editors of this book. Yes, Beth.
Good morning.
You're needing one. Does everybody else have one of these? This is a hymn that most contemporary hymnals have in some form or another. But what interests me in this case is actually this particular arrangement of it. Because it seems to me that Sam Young is here trying to accomplish a fairly specific thing when it comes to this melody, and when it comes to this pairing of words and music. And of course, these words and music are paired indissolubly. You never hear this music to any other set of words, and you never hear these words to any other set of music. At least I don't think we do. We hear different arrangements of this tune, but this is an old spiritual, and this is the form in which it always appears. Let's give it a sing. And in fact, let's do the first two verses of this thing.
We do that on 212 of the Lutheran.
Yeah, but I'd rather you use the handout.
That's all right.
Not to be a meaning, but it actually is details of the arrangement itself. And I must point out, too, this arrangement didn't survive even into the 1989 United Methodist hymnal. It wasn't, by any count, a great success. It just happens to do interesting things. I think Sam Young was up to interesting things in this particular arrangement. Let's see how it goes.
Bye.
want to follow Mary's lead and compare this to the other arrangement, but we'll wait and see if we have time. How does this tune work? And by tune, I mean the whole thing. This whole thing you have on the page in front of you.
You can put a lot more emotion into your feeling in this song.
Good.
Than most, because it's not as formal.
Yeah. Great. So, yeah. I mean, it really is a simple thing, and in a certain sense, that's exactly what it takes.
But it goes down on our knee as we go down to the lowest note.
Yeah, we sure do.
So that the picture part of it works.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Right, we do begin with this sort of gesture toward text painting. We begin with a bold thing. We're going to rise up and define this whole E-flat chord. We're going to say, dum, bum, bum. You know, we're going to, I mean, that's a big, strong opening. In Beethoven's Third Symphony, da, 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 bum. You know, in the same key. This is how Beethoven, establishes himself. You sort of have to do this kind of chord-spanning gesture. But no sooner have we done that, let us break bread together, then we realize, well, yes, but we have to do it in humility. On our knees. And so again, we just had to concede and say, okay, yeah, I only meant the E flat. I was thinking about that G. So you kind of work your way back down to the E flat. And so as we say, we're doing this on our knees. We're doing this as an act of humility. Yes, we fall to our knees. The tune falls from G to E flat.
But then we repeat it again, and it soars back up, saying how great this is.
Yeah.
You know, it comes back up again, saying, you know, it's in humility, but it's also, you know, an elevated thing. It's a grand thing to do this on our knees.
Yeah.
So it's both, you know, taken down and taken up.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah.
The meaning is in the relationship there.
Yeah. And I hope we all got that. Hold that thought. In about three more hymns, we're going to have to keep that thought in mind as we get into another communion hymn, because this is a very valuable thing that happens in several communion hymns, right? Yes, there's humility. There's also the sort of glory. Now, how much glory is there? How high does this thing get? And again, somebody who just happens to kind of have music reading is something they do. What's the highest note in this piece?
D.
D. D. On what key is this piece in?
D flat.
D flat. D is a weird highest note. It's the seventh. That's right. It's what we call the leading tone. That, you know, music theoretically, this is the leading tone. Why is it the leading tone? Because it always only does one thing. Sooner or later, it always leads up to what we call the tonic, the E flat. That is the place that we really want to come to rest. This one never gets there. D is as high as we get. Can I take the piano? Sorry. If we had, for example, Patsy Cline's I Fall to Pieces. I don't know who wrote this song, but I fall to pieces each time I see you again. I'm going to skip the next phrase. It's about love gone bad, and she can't get this guy back. You ask me to act like we've never kissed. You want me to forget, pretend we've never met. And I've tried, and I've tried, but I haven't yet. And that's as high as she gets. And exactly the same thing happens to she. And we know what's coming. That's the only note that we'll do. She never gets it. That's exactly what's happening here, I think. I mean, that's exactly what's happening musically. We get up to that second to highest, second to highest note of this sort of big scale. We want that E flat so badly, and we never get it. And
I assume that you're going to remember that.
No. Yeah.
Right.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
When someone is writing a hymn for a congregation to sing, within what range there must be a range limit that you feel is optimal?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. And that range limit has changed. In the late 19th century, we're going to sing a piece in a second that will have you, if you're a soprano, getting up to an F. Nobody in their right mind would write an F in this day and age, and I don't know why. But at the end of the 19th century, folks expected Fs of people. Now, the F was a different note, say, 250 years ago. In J.S. Bach's time, F was around an E, for us today. But no, at the end of the 19th century, folks just sang Fs. In this day and age, D is about as high as we go, and you're absolutely right. This gets up sort of as high as it's comfortable. Is that what you're...
Well, yeah, I'm surprised, because my feeling is the hymns are... I mean, the new book comes out with lower keys.
Yeah,
it seems to me they're lower.
Yes, they are. Lower. That's right. That's right. And I don't know if the assumption is there are just fewer and fewer trained voices in the congregation.
People don't sing as much.
Yeah, I think that's right.
You just don't
sing. Yeah, so that's right. Yep. But it's absolutely right that, you know, at the end of the 19th century, you could assume that you had a number of sort of trained folks or something, capable folks in the audience, who could sing, you know, a good deal higher than we ever expect people to sing today. And this is about as high as we can comfortably get, but so it goes. But again, there's this sort of marker of humility. And again, even though we're up there in the stratosphere suggesting that, yes, there's also this sort of glorious, powerful spin we're going to put on this, let us break bread together on our knees. Let us break bread more boldly together on our knees. That all that boldness really accomplishes is to make us taste this note, wanting this one, which we never get, and becoming, you know, aware that even here there's failing. So it's clear that this dum, ba, da, dum, this gesture, just these falling three notes, they're an important sort of motivic idea, an important sort of musical concept in the piece. What happens to those notes? What happens, for example, in the last line of this thing, the last system of the poem? When I fall on my knees with my face to the rising sun, O Lord, have mercy on me. What's the piano doing in the last system of this piece? Can we actually just sort of hear when I fall on my knees phrases, the last two systems again, Peter? Some more half notes. And what are all those little black notes? We're all singing the half notes. I mean, that is that, you know, much of the piece is sort of dominated. It's a kind of half note pace. Yet the piano's got all these little black notes it's throwing. What are those things? There's some eighth notes and some dotted quarters. And at the beginning of that last system, you know, mostly quarter notes.
There's a modulation.
Yeah. Well, there is a kind of modulation. That's right. F flat, we're off to sort of, you know, the grim realm of G minor, or of F minor, wherever we're headed. Oh, I'm looking at the wrong arrangement, sorry. I'm looking at the Lutherans. Get behind me, Luther. But yeah, we do go through some modulations towards the end of this thing. But in that last system, what literally are the quarter notes? Well, the quarter notes are all the same idea over and over again. When we're there with the sun, O Lord, have mercy, everything through that.
Interesting, on that last phrase, O Lord, have, until you get to the word mercy, all the quarter notes are descending.
Yes.
And so that might be the fallen nature of man, our sinfulness, and then God's mercy raises us up on the final phrase. Mercy goes up on me. Or his mercy falling down on me. That's another picture there, maybe, of the descending quarter notes.
I couldn't agree more. And that certainly seems to be kind of musically what's pushing us through this last system. Is that very idea that I was about to say a version of, but not that well. That's where we have over and over again this descending idea, the gather on our knees, this three-note descent that becomes sort of motivically significant early in the piece, and then suddenly it's just everywhere. It's throughout this last line. That is that, you know, the piano over and over again, everything is falling, 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 until this word mercy, and finally out of the hat. And we pull this rising third, and then everything is okay. Isn't there something really poignant about this?
Yes.
Could you do it as if it ever reaches the tonic and see what happens?
Well, 2:12.
It doesn't.
And I gotta say, and they don't really, they're different hymnals that have different ways of doing this, but curiously enough, most of the arrangements of this hymn that you find navigate that problem somehow. As I recall, the 1958 Pilgrim hymnal takes the easy way out. Let us break bread together on our knees. Let us break bread together on our knees. You actually sort of go up to the E flat instead of just as high as the D. But they solve the problem that way. This solves it a different way by having the sopranos do something different on the third verse. Are we all on the LBW, page 212 now, hymn 212? That is, we know you've been wanting this all this time, and finally the sopranos deliver the goods. And we had to wait till the third verse, but better late than never. Here we have all these high E flats, and suddenly everything's okay. Are we all there, and do we know what we're looking at? Yeah. I mean, that is in the third verse of the LBW's version, we get that high E flat, which to me is the exception that proves the rule. And it seems to me that Sam Young, in this other arrangement we've just been looking at, I think he knew what he was doing. I mean, I think he understood what it meant to have that as the highest note, just kind of leave it hanging. And it does seem to me, in this other way we've described, we're not actually going to sing this Lutheran version, but it does seem to me, you know, for the reasons we've described, for the reasons you articulate so well, that that last line really just is the total musical payoff, where what we have to be purged of is that descending idea, da-da-da. We just have to sort of pass through that. We have to look at his face as we do measure after measure, beat after beat, through that last system, and then see it purged with this word mercy, which finally is what we're doing here. Yes, we're in a state of humility. We're on our knees. All we can do is break bread, but my gosh, you know, there's the mercy. And all at once, well, I don't know, everything becomes clear. There are a lot of things I'd like to look at today. Any sort of closing thoughts on this beautiful hymn?
Could we just hear the difference between the quarter notes in the Lutheran one? There are four quarter notes and then two halves and then the two quarter. The difference, can you just hear that on the piano?
You mean in the Lord Have Mercy part?
Yeah, Lord, yeah.
Sure. And what if we just take the last two systems of page 212 of the LBW? Does that work, Peter?
Okay.
Okay. It's fine. But, I mean, it's a very fetching little tune, but yeah. It's up to different things, and it's just not, it doesn't accomplish the same thing. Hey, can we just, because I just happen to love this thing, can we just sing the Methodist one more time? One verse of the Methodist thing. Well, that's actually just...
Episcopalians are difficult to sing it very often.
That's right. Let's actually just take it to the... let's just take the last verse, which we haven't sung yet. 330 in that Methodist hymnal that you're hand out. But I'll say it again here. There are certain conversations here, certain hymns I will pull out, where you will feel like you're on a fishing expedition, or I'm on a fishing expedition, for this certain reading. The last hymn, for example. We ended up at exactly the place I was kind of hoping we'd end up at. With this one, I'm much less clear where we're going to end up. This is not a hymn that I have worked out at all, Abide With Me. And every time I have a conversation with somebody on the subject of this hymn, a sort of in-depth conversation, I end up feeling like I've simply never heard the tune before, because I've had students in three or four different sets of classrooms just bring very interesting thoughts to the way this tune is put together. So there's no sort of magic bullet, silver bullet here on this tune. I'm just curious what you all make of it. I have some thoughts of my own. You'll have thoughts of your own. Let us sing the first and last verses. I had to get misty-eyed about this text yesterday. I love this poem. And let's just sing the first and last verses of Abide With Me. Fire when ready. I'm sorry. The last verse. I started in on the fourth. But hold thou thy cross. Are we going to be able to do this?
The fifth.
It's on the next page. Oh, forget it. Peter, join us.
You want
we can't hold it. That's the fifth verse in harmony, but with Peter. We can't hold it, sort of going back and forth from page to page with parts. So, fifth verse. It's on the following page. That way, or do we not all experience it that way? What else? And again, just whatever random thing pops into your head.
Yeah. Well, ask for random things, but the third line I've noticed ends with tension.
Yeah.
And I think that oftentimes the word, or it seems I haven't read too closely yet in all of them, but the words seem to follow kind of a tension. Unresolved follow with the words and in the music, and in the last line takes us more to a resolution again. I think that's part of the comfort of it, is that it creates the tension and it resolves it again.
Fantastic. Let's get off the bus there for a minute. What happens in the third line? You're absolutely right. We have four very simple phrases here, musical phrases, four lines of poetry, and it's in the third that things really begin to go wrong. When other helpers fail and comforts flee. Let's get off the bus for a moment and talk about the melodic structure of this thing. I mean, this line, isn't it supposed to be the same as the first line? Isn't that how it went? Mm-hmm. Abide with me, fast falls the eventide. Mm-hmm. When other helpers fail and comforts flee. What went wrong? Mm-hmm. Suddenly we're at a much more higher level of tension. The melodies of that first and third phrase are very similar. Where did the difference happen? What went wrong?
It doesn't come to a conclusion that it wants to go ahead.
Right, right, right. Then in that first case, we ended on this very cozy, G note, which is in the major, chord. There we are on our E flat chord. Everything is great. And then suddenly I'm about to sit down at the piano, but I won't. But suddenly we sort of go through that third phrase again, and we end on a different note. We end on this F, and suddenly we're in an F minor chord. Everything is happy, everything is resolved. We end on exactly the same chord we started with. There's nothing wrong. What's going wrong? Well, nothing. Nothing but eventide. And the sun's going down. We've lived through this before. It's going to come up. But then we sort of make our way into this. The darkness deepens. Lord, with me abide. And things begin the same way in that second phrase, or third phrase. Now, what exactly went wrong melodically? It feels like we're saying the same melody twice, but then, literally, what sort of note by note? What makes the third phrase different from the first phrase?
Well, instead of ascending to the C in the third bar, it stays on the B flat.
Yeah.
And so all the notes from that point on to the end of the phrase are a step lower.
Right.
Which means we're going to have to harmonize it differently.
Yes, that's right. And so we end up on this F instead of this G. And I hope this isn't losing anybody too badly. But that's right. This one thing goes wrong. We get up to when other helpers fail and comforts flee. That's what we want. That's what we got the first time. That's not what we get. Those helpers fail. And on that word fail, we fail to go up. When other helpers fail and comforts flee. And the whole thing is derailed. This one little sort of break has taken place in the melody at its midpoint, and everything after that just sort of slides down a step. And suddenly we're in this sort of catastrophic new place. Instead of ending in this sort of comforting E flat exactly where we started, suddenly we're in this sort of F minor, this very strange high tension territory. You put it very well. What does that accomplish? That for the tune to do that, I don't know. Let's meditate a little further on this.
Well, it's because of that tension. You want it not to be tense in the last line. You want it to resolve itself. So when you sing it with that intention. You don't care. I don't even think you care if it's the notes are that way. You're going to do it that way anyway. You're going to make it come back home.
It adds some variety.
Yeah, it does. It does.
It also creates kind of an interesting contrast. The second line ends with tension, but it's a positive tension. It's an uplifting, expectant tension. And the third line is this kind of dark, low, danger tension.
Right.
The first line is comfortable, we got it. The second line is something good is going to happen. Third line is, something bad is going to happen. And in the end, you resolve the end.
Right.
It's okay.
Yeah, I couldn't agree
more.
It's
like a whole story is taking
right.
us through.
Right. Uh-huh. That seems absolutely right to me. And there are a certain number of hymn tunes that are structured this way. But this does it extremely effectively. And I guess I can't help suspecting that there isn't some resonance between the way the tune accomplishes this. Maybe somebody in the room can know a little more about this than me. I suspect that it may be Plato's or Aristotle's Poetics or something, where we first start getting this idea of the chiasmus talked about, the cross. But a concept that continues to be extremely important in literary criticism of various kinds, that the chiasmus is extremely important. And it's a chiasmus is a place where you have a repetition, but an important reversal. In one classic moment, for example, at the end of the last story in James Joyce's Dubliners, the main character is sitting there looking out at the snow falling, thinking about death, and he looks out and he sees the snow falling faintly and faintly falling. And goodness knows what Joyce means by this, but the snow is doing that. It's falling faintly and faintly falling. And this is a classic sort of chiasmus. We have the same two words, but just kind of switched. Chiasmus works in literature when we have something like characters that encounter one another in this, in some sort of grim situation, yet their roles are reversed somehow. For example, James Bond is suddenly about to be eaten by, Goldfinger sharks or whoever sharks they are. But then, at the last moment, we find them coming into an encounter in which their roles are reversed, and suddenly James Bond is the one with the power. And in a contemporary blockbuster movie, this almost never happens without the protagonist at that point quoting something from earlier in the movie that is sort of, some line that was previously said in a snide way now comes back in a, it comes out of his own mouth in a victorious way. That is, there are all kinds of ways that reversals can happen. I guess it feels to me as though that's exactly what's happened in comparing musically the first and the third lines of this thing. We have this perfectly comforting, at home, nice first line, da 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 da, everything's great. Then it comes back with the same two pairs, but somehow something has gone wrong. And rather than having sort of a melody that leads from sort of the normal place to the normal place, from home to home, da 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 da, we have the same melody, but something about it has been fundamentally shifted, such that it now goes to a wrong place, to the darkest, the scariest place of the piece, da 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 da. And I respectfully submit that this tune may match the text so well because that's what the text is doing to us time and again. This text comes out of the starting gate as though it's a hymn about evening. And it is not a hymn about evening. It's a hymn about dying. And what we have to do is relive the same kind of imagery time and again. When other helpers fail and comforts flee, help of the helpless, Lord, abide with me. That is that we get this sense by the end that somehow things are getting more serious. It isn't just that evening is falling. It's that, well, God is the only helper, that all my other helpers have fled. And in a certain sense, there in that third line of the first verse, the ante has been upped. By the end of the last verse, it's clear we're not talking about evening at all. We're trotting over much the same kind of ground. The light is draining away. The friends have abandoned us, and we're just descending into darkness. But we realize, we're not talking about night. We're talking about dying, and we're talking about just trying to find some way to keep our eyes on the cross as we do it. And that's how the poem works so magically, is to sort of go over the same ground, to go over the same kind of imagery, but to show us, the imagery is much more serious. There's a much darker hue to this than we ever imagined the first time through. And I guess it seems to me the melody teaches us that, even before the words do. The melody makes us experience that, sort of going over the same ground twice, once innocently, once depressing, and once with an awareness of the tragedy or the terror that's really at hand. Can we take that to the bank? Does that make any sense? Yeah.
Not being in the musical field, maybe this is a naive question, but Peter, who writes hymns today, and how do they compare to these nuances that you're setting forward?
That is a lovely question.
And we need with one voice to prove that.
Yeah, well, no, we don't, in fact. We have Now the Silence. On page 205 of the Lutheran Book of Worship, hymn 205, let us go to a hymn being written today by a pair of hymn writers, that is, a writer of texts and a writer of tunes, who have done other work together. The United Methodists got one tune from this pair, which was God of the Sparrow, God of the Sparrow, God of the Whale. It's a really neat little tune that I don't think the Lutherans have got yet. Maybe, is it in with one voice or something?
It's in the UCC
hymn market, and it's in the United Methodist Hymn. Hymn. You all don't have that one, but you have this one. I'm not there yet, 205. And I guess I have this vague inkling that the kinds of things we're talking about here, indeed the kinds of, I mean, almost like the kind of chiasmus we're describing, going over the same ground, but sort of changing things such that something is transformed, and doing, again, that thing we did in the first communion hymn that we looked at, sort of repeating the same melody, but a good deal higher, as we did in Let Us Break Bread Together on Our Knees. This hymn, Now the Silence, does a lot of those things. And let's just sort of take this as a segue that fell from the sky and get on to this other hymn, to talk about a way in which a contemporary hymn writer, almost contemporary, Carl Schoen is still alive, he's not a not a young man, but he's but he is still very active in writing hymns. And I've met Carl Schalk, and Mark, I think you've met our text writer here. People who just sort of vibrant figures in the hymn appreciating community as well as the hymn writing community. And it seems to me, and I hope this will strike you as a worthy answer to your question, seems to me that they really do have their eyes on the prize where this kind of thing is concerned, and they really are interested in trying to accomplish much this kind of thing. After we get through this sort of high arty hymn, I'll come back to where you may have been going with that question, which is, what do we do with the junk, which seems to be abounding? That is, there are many kinds of music that get generated in many churches that really don't seem to address this sort of high art question in any way. Is that where you were hoping to go with that question? Good. I want to go there too. Let's see if after Now the Silence. Let's hear this thing, Now the Silence. This is a hymn that I, by the way, this what you're about to do now is the first time I've ever heard this hymn sung. I've never heard it used in real life, but let's hear it. Something that we almost never find in this hymnal, and that is we have what's called a through-composed melody here, which is to say there are no verses. He didn't have to fit more than one verse to the same set of music. He started at the beginning of the poem and he composed his way straight to the end, or maybe the reverse happened. I mean, I don't actually know whether music or poem came first, but the point is that it is what we call through-composed as opposed to strophic. Strophic meaning the way that all the other hymnals in this book work, having more than one stanza to the same set of music. This, he gets to write new music straight along the way. And what does he do with that privilege? How does this thing work?
My first impression is that the rhythm's a little jarring.
Okay.
Where you know, kind of stops. You got to just kind of get used to this rhythm, and then it holds.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's, I don't like that. It hurts.
But I think if we sang it a couple more times, it wouldn't be so jumpy sounding. It's our first
right.
time. But I think it's telling a story. It's like telling a little child. Okay, now they're going to do this. Now they're going to do this. Now they're going to do this. Now we're going to do this.
Yep.
Now we're going to do this.
Yep.
And it gets exciting, and it gets slower, and it gets exciting, and it gets slower by the different parts of the service.
Right. Doesn't it, in a way, since he's knowing he's not going to have any more new verses, give him a freedom?
Yeah, it does.
A little bit,
yeah.
I mean, he can, with his imagination, roam free.
Absolutely. Yes, he can. And he runs with it. He does. He takes a much more sort of sophisticated, complex solution than he had to. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
And Franz Peter Schubert, for example, the fellow who, before his very untimely death of syphilis in 1828, you know, Franz Peter Schubert, in his 31 years of life, created art song. He sort of invented the art song as we know it, the German art song. And his work is divided not 50-50, but something on that order between strophic songs, that is where he takes a text and repeats stanzas to the same music over and over again, and songs where he does it this way, he sort of through composes them. And you know, they both have their value, and you can accomplish different things in both contexts, but art song composers tend to love to do it this way for the reasons you describe, because it just kind of lets you show off, it lets you, you know, let your imagination take wing. And yeah, Schalk certainly runs with it here.
Who was that? I missed the name.
Oh, Schubert.
Oh, I mean, you said the one had syphilis.
Yes.
Oh, Schubert.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, did he have?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I know his art song.
But yeah, it was not a. No, let's not go there. But in this case, okay. And by the way, why does this feel sort of rhythmically lopsided? This is, to me, potentially a very interesting question. What goes wrong with the rhythm? Why does it feel sort of?
Probably eighth notes.
Yeah, that certainly.
It's an unusual meter for a hymn.
Well, it's not
6/8.
Yeah.
It's a triple meter.
Yeah,
and
it is.
And the accent shifts.
Well,
isn't
yeah.
It
isn't
always
there's
one.
There's
one shifting accents here.
Oh, no measures.
You know, apparently Lutherans, and there are Lutherans in the room. Lutherans, do you believe that bar lines are the devil's workshop or something? why does this hymnal have so few measures?
People, he has many interpretations.
Anyway, but if we had to put measures in, how would we put them in? Somebody has already articulated this, but I'll go ahead and sort of and kind of cut to the chase with this. I mean, if we had to count it, we would all want to count in what we think of as a 1, 2, 3, 2, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 2, 2, 3, 2, 3, 2, 3, 2, 3, now the sigh. 1, 2, 1, 2, 2, 2, 1, 2, the 1, 2. I guess it sort of works its way out. I mean, it sort of falls out into a meter. I don't know. I'm not sure what it is. It feels like one leg is shorter than the other for some reason.
Yeah.
And I don't quite know what it is. 2, 3, 4, 5. Yes, I do. It's because there are five of those things. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bar phrases, which is
unusual.
I'm going to take the piano. We do every so often, a piece like yesterday. All my troubles seem so far yesterday. Now it looks as though seven measures long. Michelle, as my 12-year-old recently pointed out to me, the Beatles song Michelle falls out in 5-measure phrases, and it sounds perfectly normal. How does Paul McCartney do it? He's a genius. Carl Schalk is very good, but I don't know if he's a Paul McCartney or not. Anyway, but now the silence. You know, these are 5-bar phrases that feel like 5-bar phrases. They really do sound kind of lopsided. I never thought of this before, but whoever said this, hats off. You're absolutely right. There's something kind of weird about the way the meter works here. They're 5-bar ideas. What else happens in the course of these quarters? What else can we say about the trajectory of the whole thing? We've done so much talking, the piece is probably kind of out of our ears at this point, but what does happen as it unfolds?
Can we sing it again?
Yeah, let's just sing it again.
Mm-hmm. We go down the quarter and half notes at the last. We smooth it out.
See, the notes are put together from start to finish.
Yeah, it did.
What's the story it's telling? What's the music trying to get across? And how much time do we have to settle this? Do we have a couple minutes left?
30 seconds.
No, we can do it until 5. It's a buffet dinner, you guys.
Oh, okay. Well, no, we're going to wrap things up.
I'm looking long.
My wife is back there, and she doesn't have my kids, and I want to hear the story. So.
Well, I don't know, you know, what it means to other people, but the first part of the song to me is, you know, having communion, getting ready for communion. And then when you get to the celebration, then the second, this part over here is at, to me, is after the communion.
Okay.
And now it's going to continue in me. That's what I get out of it.
That's a great idea. That's a great idea.
Well, we used it for our daughter's wedding. Our son sang it just to begin the whole thing now. Now we celebrate.
Fantastic.
And it was kind of a favorite part.
That's great. That's great.
I didn't remember that.
Yep.
From a personal standpoint who writes music, I guess, the now the wedding, now the songs, now the heart of forgiving, weeping, where he starts downing in, it almost like he has more to say. Like you said, it's a run-on song, and he has more to say, but he wants to, can't keep going up with it, so he's got to start back over.
Right, that's a great idea.
To me, it's, the music sounds like the leading up to a wedding, the end of it's like the wedding bells, kind of the rhythm of it. But then the words create the metaphor between, you know, a marriage and our relationship with God. Mm-hmm. The words are about our relationship with God, so the music and the words together create an analogy between, you know, us coming to God and two people getting married.
Yeah.
We say it's the feast of celebration. We say that when we do our own liturgy. This is a feast of celebration.
Yeah.
This is what this is a feast and celebration.
Do you think that the metrical irregularity has something to do with the fact that there's this tension between everything now, but everything in sequence? So there's sort of sequential movement, this, and then this, and then this, but everything begins now. So there's a kind of discrepant eternal present going on. And then there's the other disjunction they talked about this first there's communion, then something else. And so all of this metrical problematic you got out is kind of enacting this weird temporal stuff going on in the world.
Sounds great. And it's so well said, I think we should let that be our last word. And do join me once more in thanking Peter, our accompanist, who did a great job.